You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, public defender's offices in northern Wisconsin are having a hard time finding lawyers, and they're doing some creative marketing. We'll find out why and look at the issue of low reimbursement rates for lawyers representing indigent defendants. Right now, we're checking in with reporters from around the state about the stories they've been covering this week. First, the federal government announced plans to close a job training center for disadvantaged youth in northern Wisconsin's Forest County, a move that drew condemnation from the area's Republican congressman. Rob Menster is WPR's Rural Communities reporter. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks.
Well, can you tell us a bit about the Blackwell Job Corps Center? What does it do? What has it been doing?
So this is a center in Leona, Wisconsin, so up in the Northwoods in the Shequamigan-Nicolet National Forest. And it's a job training center for disadvantaged youth, so that's people ages 16 to 24, and they're able to get their high school diploma as well as concurrently get training in a trade. They have a carpentry program, but also medical professions, also masonry and other labor programs there. And when they graduate, it's sort of like a pre-apprenticeship. And then in a lot of cases, the job center will connect them directly with jobs in Wisconsin.
Do we have a sense of how big an impact the center has had on job seekers and job providers in the region?
So there are hundreds of students that go through each year, and the source I talked to, I tried to speak to the representatives of the center itself, and they can't talk to the news media. They're federal employees, and they're under a gag order from speaking to the media. But I did reach an ex-employee who had access to various data about their impact, and he cited 786 students in the last 5 years that they had directly placed in quality jobs, so jobs in their trade. That's across Wisconsin, but I mean that's a big number.
Now we have this nationwide shakeup coming from the White House. Why is this center being closed?
So the program, through sort of a historical quirk, the program was administered by the Agriculture Department under the USDA Forest Service, and it's part of this New Deal era Civilian Conservation Corps. This specific center doesn't go back all that far, but the national program does for these job centers, and they're rearranging that. So they are moving that from the Agriculture Department to the auspices of the Labor Department, which maybe makes some sense. You can see why that would, why it would fall under the Labor Department. But then the second part of that is that the Labor Department is broadly restructuring it, which includes transferring, in a bunch of cases, 16 cases, I think, the services to private contractors, and then just outright closing 9 additional centers. And the one in Leona is one of those that is slated for closure.
Now, Republican Congressman Sean Duffy represents the area. He's talked about this. What have we heard from him?
Yeah, his office provided me with a letter that he sent to the Labor Department expressing great consternation, was the quote, over the change. And he points out, so one of the Labor Department's rationales for the closure is that there is another job center available in Wisconsin, but it's in Milwaukee. So for someone in Duffy's district in the north of the state and anywhere near, Leona, that's quite a hike, and that's quite that may seem out of reach to a lot of people. So he has expressed that he believes it's important to keep the center open and that he's going to try to advocate for that. We will see whether what that amounts to, what that comes to. But there's a Republican legislator who is pretty strongly opposed to this closure.
Do we have a sense of the timeline when the closure would go into effect?
There are public comments. There's a sort of public comment period immediately. The closures are said to be planned to be completed by the end of the year.
And the public comments would be collected, I guess, at this point by the Labor Department, since they're going to end up being in charge. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct.
We'll leave it there. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Hey, thanks.
Rob Menster is WPR's Rural Communities reporter with us to talk about the closing announcement of the Blackwell Job Corps Center in Leona. Now, high water levels on the Mississippi River are slowing down shipping, and a wet spring is delaying the planting season for many farmers around the state. Hope Kerwin is a WPR reporter based in La Crosse. Hope, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with flooding on the Mississippi River, where the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is having to make extra plans for dredging parts of the river. How has a year of wet weather created challenges with the sediment in the river?
Yeah, so during a typical spring, the Army Corps of Engineers dredges two or three locations on the Mississippi River. And this year, they're looking at dredging 12 to 14. So a huge increase in the amount of dredging they're having to do. And they're really saying that this stems from the wet weather we've had, not only this spring, but really tracing all the way back to the fall. You know, we saw frequent rains last fall, a lot of snow this winter, and now frequent rains again this spring. And that's basically caused a lot of sediment to end up not only in the Mississippi River and its backwaters, but also tributaries like the Chippewa, the Black River, the Trempealeau River. And so all of that has been flushed into the main channel and is ending up in these trouble locations that they're having to dredge.
And is there a concern that this could affect shipping then on the Mississippi?
So shipping has definitely already been impacted on the Mississippi, but not necessarily because of the dredging. They'll definitely have to dredge those locations once water returns to normal levels. But because water has been so high, it's actually caused a lot of lock closures farther down the river towards St. Louis. Now, that is a major port for shipping on the Mississippi River. So barge traffic in our area has actually been very, very low and almost non-existent because they can't get to that port of destination in St. Louis. You know, I talked to one person from a barge company. He basically said it's been like the season hasn't even started for them.
And now the soggy spring is also having an impact on farmers around the state who are being delayed in planting their corn. How badly is this wet weather affecting corn growers?
Yeah, it's been a huge challenge for farmers this year. So the latest crop progress report, which came out on Monday, found that only 46% of the state's corn acres have been planted at this point. That's 2 weeks behind the average timeline. And the same has been said for soybean growers. They're only at about 20% planted, which is 13 days behind average. And so this is a big deal because May 31st today is actually a huge crop insurance deadline for farmers. And so if they don't have their corn acres planted by this point, they could either take a hit on their coverage levels of crop insurance, or they might have to take a payout from their insurance program and just not plant those acres.
So there's that crop insurance issue, the planting time, the weather, tariffs from China, relief from the federal government, a lot of uncertainty. You talked to a UW Extension agricultural agent who works with growers. In our last few moments, what are you hearing about the mood out there for farmers?
He basically said there's just a lot of uncertainty. He was, you know, it's his job to help farmers make decisions. And he said, unfortunately, they just don't have a lot of information to help them make those decisions this year about what to plant or what to do.
We'll leave it there for now. Hope, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Hope Kerwin, WPR's reporter based in La Crosse. She was with us to talk about the effects of a long winter and rainy spring, both on Mississippi River levels, a need to dredge there, and a slow start for corn growers around the state. She joined us as part of our weekly roundup of news from around Wisconsin. There's a shortage of lawyers to represent defendants who can't afford an attorney in northern Wisconsin, and that's led to some creative marketing. Last week, a local office of the state public defender in Spooner sent out an email looking for help from attorneys across the state. Their new approach? Hoping list of tourist attractions in the area might get lawyers to take on cases being heard sometimes hours away from them for little pay. Kelly Thompson is the Wisconsin State Public Defender, and Ryan Reed is the regional attorney manager for the State Public Defender's Superior Region, which includes that Spooner office. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me as well.
Ryan, let's start with you. What prompted this email from the State Public Defender's Office in Spooner looking for lawyers from the rest of the state?
Well, thank you. So in our area, there's not a lot of private bar that are taking our cases or able to take our cases. So we've gotten pretty creative trying to, you know, target other parts of the state to get people to come up to Spooner, Hayward, Burnett County, and take our cases. So we try to, you know, obviously talk about, you know, what types of cases they are, court dates, that the courts are flexible. But we'll also say there's other things up here to do while you're here, just to, be creative and get people interested in taking our cases up here.
And Kelly, take us statewide now. What do things look like when it comes to trying to get public defenders, to get lawyers to show up and work as public defenders?
Well, thank you very much. So what is happening is we're a statewide public defense system in Wisconsin. We're very fortunate to have a statewide public defense system. We have fantastic public defenders throughout the state. But our staff attorneys cannot take all of the cases in the state. They can they have conflict cases and what we call overflow cases, just volume cases that sometimes our attorneys can't handle, again, because of the volume, because of the time and the workload. So we contract with private bar attorneys. Again, fantastic attorneys, private attorneys throughout the state who are willing to take our cases at the $40 an hour rate, which is the lowest rate in the nation. So statewide, this has been a really difficult issue. And over the last couple of years, especially the last year, a year and a half, 2 years actually, it has continued to be increasingly difficult, and I would say at a crisis level for us now.
And Kelly, let's talk about that number. People might hear $40 an hour. That sounds like a pretty sweet gig. Talk about what that means for paying a lawyer, though.
Certainly. So $40 an hour was what the rate was set when it was cut in 1995. And it has not changed. And that $40 an hour rate has to cover multiple things, not just that hourly rate for the attorney, but any overhead that they have. And what we're hearing from attorneys, they are losing money on our cases.
So they might be paying paralegals, they might be paying filing charges out of that.
Right. And what's happening is these attorneys that are fantastic attorneys, willing to do this work, want to be involved in indigent defense, but also be private attorneys, they aren't able to even have offices. They're not able to keep the lights on. They are now working out of their homes and their cars, which is also not necessarily always efficient or effective to run a law practice. So we're losing those small businesses downtown that would line the main streets because they're not able to do that anymore at that $40 an hour rate. And I can't emphasize enough that $40 an hour rate is the lowest in the nation. And so as fantastic Wisconsin is, where our economy is booming and unemployment is low, these attorneys are having to say no to us multiple times. In places like where Ryan is talking about, they're sometimes calling 500 and 600 attorneys or more across the state, asking them to come up and take these cases. And it's not just about us. It's about these individual people who are oftentimes sitting in custody waiting for their cases to be heard and we're not able to get them representation.
Ryan, can you talk about that? What kind of things are defendants in northern Wisconsin in particular facing when it comes to that wait for representation?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's, I was actually just on the record the other day with the judge asking me, we have a serious case, and he said, quite frankly, Ryan, how long is it going to take? And I said, well, it could be, we could put it out this week and we could get someone this week, or it could be 2 months, it could be 4 months, it could be 6 months. What makes it hard is the conflict cases. So, if there's a situation where there's four people involved, we can take that one person, and usually we can get, an attorney for the second person, but that third and fourth client, that person sitting in custody, has to wait sometimes 4 to 6 months for us to find an attorney that's willing to take a complex case, and they just—it's tough. It's heartbreaking sitting next to someone for a bail hearing or a status hearing, and not being able to do anything to assist them. So, but with these emails and targeting people, we've definitely improved our ability to get attorneys up in this area of the state. But it's still a challenge.
Kelly?
Well, I was going to say we're fortunate. We maybe have some light at the end of this tunnel. Joint Finance met this week on the public defender budget, and they approved to increase the rate to $70 starting January 1st, 2020, which is just tremendous. This is our first increase since 1995, and this is has had bipartisan support. So, again, we're really excited about this. This has had the governor's support. This has had the legislature's support. Ryan can talk about the judges and court personnel and county boards up in his area, but throughout the state that are so excited that we might be able to get this right. And they have been talking individually and specifically about their counties and about what they're seeing, and that has helped tremendously. We've had Department of Justice and we've had the chief of the Supreme Court all talking about this issue. So it's brought a lot of attention on a really difficult problem, but it's also talked about just how important our constitutional rights are for every individual in the state of Wisconsin.
We're talking to Kelly Thompson, Wisconsin State Public Defender, and Ryan Reed, Regional Attorney Manager for the State Public Defender's Superior Region. Ryan, let's stick with that number, $70 an hour. What do you see that changing when it comes to bringing in lawyers to provide this public defender work?
I think it's really going to help get people taking our cases in the area. I think it's going to make it, you know, realistic for new attorneys and seasoned attorneys to come up to these areas and open a practice, or for people that have a practice to expand their practice. You know, Kelly was talking about that $40 an hour. I mean, I keep hearing, you know, taking your cases, I would be operating at a loss. Like, I can't afford to do it anymore. And attorneys that really enjoy, you know, not just giving back by taking these cases, but enjoy criminal defense, we're just, I can't afford to take them, so they took other work. But I think the $70 an hour is really going to help us get people to reconsider taking our cases and to get people taking our cases again.
And Kelly, you mentioned the $40 rate right now makes us the lowest in the nation. Do we know what 70 would put us at in terms of other states?
We don't, only because we were talking about the hourly rate, because each states do it differently. But what we've done is tried to find a number that we believe and it's all anecdotal, there's nothing scientific, talking to attorneys across the state, something that feasibly that the legislature would be able to agree to because of the fiscal impact that it has. And again, it's for us a 75% increase, which is pretty significant. We're hoping this is a starting point, that we've been able to highlight an issue, and that, again, working with individual legislators as well as the entire legislature, both Republicans and Democrats and the executive branch and the courts, this has been really important. And I think it's really highlighted just the important work that our public defenders do and our private attorneys that take our cases. And it really is vital work to the criminal justice system.
And Ryan, I've talked to state lawmakers on the show in the past who have said a lot of parts of Wisconsin, especially rural parts of Wisconsin, don't have enough lawyers, period. Not just public defenders, but attorneys in general. Do you think that is a part of the problem that needs to be tackled? Even if you're bringing an attorney from Milwaukee, it seems like it'd be more convenient to have somebody within a, you know, hour and a half drive instead of a 5-hour drive.
No, and I agree. And I think part of the issue with the low rate is, you know, if you're a young attorney starting out or an attorney thinking of moving their practice, our cases sometimes are really helpful to get people in the door, you know, get that practice open. And I think the $40 an hour has been kind of a barrier to people considering coming to this area. So I think having it being $70 an hour would really help. I mean, I don't think it's, as Kelly said, I think it's a first step. I don't think it's going to be, you know, completely solve the problem, but I think it's going to be definitely a good first step to get people up here and to be a way to get people to consider maybe more moving to rural Wisconsin and these areas where we are missing a lot of attorneys, not just for our cases, but, you know, family law cases, small claims, et cetera.
Kelly, did you want to jump in on that?
I was going to just agree with Ryan. I think Wisconsin is a beautiful state, and up in northern and rural parts of Wisconsin are gorgeous. And getting people to visit and perhaps take cases up there, perhaps they'll see how important and critical they are to the local fabric and the local communities, and will open their practices. We've been working with the law schools on this. This is an issue that people are aware of, getting especially those young attorneys to move into those already existing practices or open up their own practices in rural Wisconsin. We need people up in those areas.
Now, I know with the public defender shortage in northern Wisconsin, there has actually been a suit filed in the name of some defendants who have had long waits in jail. I know your name is involved in this suit, Kelly. I don't know how much you can talk about that, but is there something you can say about that suit?
Unfortunately, because it's a pending suit. There's not much I can say about it. It is moving through the courts. But at this point in time, there isn't much I can say about it. I'm hoping that with the increase from $40 to $70, that will alleviate a number of the issues that were pointed out in the lawsuit, and that is the lack of attorneys taking our cases.
And Ryan, as we wrap up, there was this email campaign to try to get attorneys from elsewhere in Wisconsin. Have you gotten any payoff from that?
We have. You know, being more direct with our, I hate to say marketing, but being more direct with our marketing and our targeting, you know, being creative and, you know, really being persistent with attorneys, I think it really has helped improve our ability to offer, you know, a constitutional right to assistance of counsel. So I really applaud my clerical staff for, you know, going above and beyond and really focusing on these attorneys and really helping our clients. So I think it has.
Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kelly, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thank you so much. I do really appreciate it. It's an important issue to highlight, and anytime we can come in and talk about the criminal justice system, we're happy to.
Ryan Reed is the regional attorney manager for the State Public Defender's Superior Region, and Kelly Thompson is the Wisconsin State Public Defender. They join us to talk about the reimbursement rate for lawyers representing indigent defendants. That's one that's currently the lowest in the nation at $40 an hour. They say it's making it hard to provide timely trials in many parts of the state. Two leaders of a Rastafarian church in Madison were arrested this week after the church was raided by police. They now face tentative drug-related charges, including delivery of marijuana. They had provided marijuana to parishioners in exchange for donations, they said. They say the practice is constitutionally protected because marijuana is considered a sacrament in their church. Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. He's also an affiliate faculty member of the UW Law School. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, let's look at this claim from members of this self-described Rastafarian church in Madison. They say they use marijuana, in effect, as a sacrament in their religious practice. Therefore, it should be constitutionally protected. Do you see it as likely that a court would accept that argument?
Right. So we've got to break this down into two distinct parts. One is the U.S. Constitution. One is the Wisconsin Constitution. Under the U.S. Constitution, there is no argument. And what I mean by that is the Supreme Court has said very, very clearly, states have no obligation to give accommodations to religious practices with respect to generally applicable laws. So, for example, if you imagine prohibition, a ban on alcohol, you know, states may make an exception for sacramental uses of alcohol, but they don't have to. By extension, there's absolutely no obligation under the U.S. Constitution for Wisconsin to make an exception for sacramental uses of marijuana under a generally applicable state law. But the Wisconsin Constitution is different. The Wisconsin Constitution has been held by the Wisconsin State Supreme Court to be more protective of religious freedom than the U.S. Constitution. That was in a 1996 case. So under the Wisconsin Constitution, there are two questions. First, the church would have to show that they're acting on the basis of a genuine religious belief. And that's a topic that judges generally are hesitant to weigh in on. That is, we don't want courts to be judging people's descriptions of their religious beliefs or practices and saying, no, this is not really what your religion requires, or dictating, you know, what constitutes a sincere religion. But the second part is, even if this is a religious sacrament, Wisconsin can still punish it if Wisconsin can show a compelling interest. And so a year ago, or July in 2018, in Indiana, there was a church called the First Church of Cannabis. A case came to an Indiana court, and the judge there had no trouble finding that Indiana had a compelling interest in uniform application of drug laws. And I expect a similar outcome here, frankly. That is, I expect Wisconsin will argue, will not lean heavily on the argument this, about whether this is or is not a true religion, but rather will simply say, look, we have a compelling interest in preventing the use of marijuana. And that being the case, we have no obligation to grant these people an exemption.
Do we have examples in Wisconsin, or I guess beyond, where courts have said, yes, this is generally illegal in our state, but we will give this wiggle room for religious reasons?
Well, not specifically for marijuana, at least not that I've found. There have been a number of cases in California, including several involving Rastafarian churches, but the churches have always lost. On the other hand, the Wisconsin State Supreme Court established this principle of stronger than U.S. Federal protection in the context of employment discrimination. And there are several cases, including one from 2012, which the Wisconsin State Supreme Court has said. Religious employers are not obliged to comply with anti-discrimination statutes where the employment issue involves the religious operations of their church. That's as close as we have to a direct precedent in Wisconsin, at least that I know of. But my expectation, frankly, is that this rather politically conservative state Supreme Court will simply say, well, marijuana is different, drugs are different, this is a matter of criminal law enforcement and what are called state police powers, which are the traditional powers of the states to establish limits of permissible conduct. And I strongly suspect we'll end up with an outcome that says the Wisconsin state constitution does protect employers, religious employers, from the operations of some anti-discrimination laws, but does not protect the Rastafarian church from the operation of the anti-marijuana law.
Talking to Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison, looking at religious liberty and where it can come into conflict in our legal system, a case in Wisconsin and Madison in particular, a Rastafarian church in Madison raided, a couple leaders arrested under a variety of marijuana-related charges. Now, you mentioned that discrimination law. That seems like it's been the frontier of religious liberty laws, both in the courts and in legislatures, state and national. Do you see that as kind of the main flashpoint when it comes to when can an organization be exempted from regulation because of religious reasons?
Well, it's not the only one. That certainly has been a flashpoint recently. So I mentioned a case from Indiana from last summer, and of course that involved the famous or infamous religious freedom law that Mike Pence signed into law and that many critics claimed would protect discriminating employers. So right now, I mean, these days, yeah, that's a very current issue, and it's the forefront of a lot of debates. But historically, if you go back even 5, 10, 15 years, there are a slew of areas where claims of religious free exercise have been brought up to assert an entitlement to an exemption from a generally applicable law. Think about something like Hobby Lobby, for example, whether employers can be required to pay the insurance costs of contraception. You know, that was about basically the same question.
And do we have a lot of case law built up over the course of American history on issues for various churches, maybe for laws or reasons that aren't as relevant in 2019?
Sure. Well, under the U.S. Constitution, there's a really sharp break. Prior to 1990, the rule was anytime a state wants to apply a law in a way that will put a burden on religious practice, the state has to meet a very, very high level of justification. It's called strict scrutiny. In 1990, the Supreme Court issued an opinion written by Justice Scalia for a majority of the court that said that's not true. States have no constitutional obligation to provide accommodations at all. They can do so if they want to, but they don't have to. So a very famous case from the early 1970s is Wisconsin versus Yoder, in which the U.S. Supreme Court held that the state of Wisconsin could not compel Amish families to send their kids to high school. And that was, right, there was a generally applicable law saying up until a certain age, everyone had to attend school. The Amish were claiming a religious exemption, and the Supreme Court said, yes, you're entitled to this exemption. But that was under the old pre-1990 rules. Post-1990, all of the history of analysis of free exercise protection under the U.S. Constitution is largely rendered irrelevant, which is why I'm focusing so much on the Wisconsin state constitution, because if this Rastafarian church has a claim, that will be its basis.
Now, you said that courts are reluctant to judge whether an organization meets some kind of standard of what constitutes a religious organization or what practice meets the definition of a religious faith. That said, I could see a case where somebody set up a fake religious organization in order to conduct some kind of illegal activity. I think some people have accused this case at Madison. We can't judge that here, of course, using this as a front, a cover for the exchange of cash for marijuana. So is there a case where a court might say, wait a minute, this religious veneer is phony?
Well, there is. There are a couple. So I don't know a specific Wisconsin case, but at the federal level, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case in which a native a church claiming to be devoted to a Native American religion wanted to get an exemption against laws about using peyote, and that was rejected. The reason was the church had not existed very long; it had only a few adherents. It met in somebody's house. Essentially, without quite saying it in so many words, the Supreme Court said, "Look, we don't think this is a real church." In the Indiana case that I mentioned, that involved a church called the First Church of Cannabis. And certainly in the press coverage, there was a considerable amount of speculation that this was not a real church. This was just an excuse to smoke marijuana. The Indiana judge in that case refused to address that question because she didn't find it necessary. She just focused on the compelling state interest. So, yes, there is some precedent. And if the Wisconsin courts wanted to lean on that question, they could talk about how long this religion has existed, how many adherents it has, whether the members of the church engage in frequent and regular religious practice together. If the Wisconsin courts were to lean on that question, that is, take it upon themselves to say, we don't believe yours is a true religion, that could raise U.S. constitutional questions. But my suspicion is they won't do that. My suspicion is they will simply lean on the second half, the compelling interest half, and say, look, we're not going to touch that question. All we need to say is that Wisconsin has a sufficient compelling interest, and the argument is over.
We're talking to Howard Schwaber of UW-Madison's Law School about how far religious freedom protections go. That's after a Rastafarian church in Madison claimed their ability to practice their religion was infringed upon when police raided the church and arrested its leaders this week on marijuana charges. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of religious freedom claims in this case in particular? And also, when religious freedom claims come into conflict with the law, where should the state, where should courts put the weight? Should we give a lot of leeway on religious liberty? Or if it's illegal in one case, is religion not an excuse? What questions do you have about how all this works at the state and federal level? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about a Rastafarian church in Madison. Leaders say their religious rights were infringed on after organizers were arrested for marijuana-related charges. They claim that marijuana is part of their religious practice and therefore constitutionally protected. Howard Schwaber is with us, constitutional law expert with UW-Madison, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this case? Do you think the church and its leaders have a valid claim to religious freedom? Do you think that they should be allowed to legally use and distribute marijuana under the auspices of religious practice, or no? And what questions do you have for our guest about the broader issue of religious liberty and how it works out in the court system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Now, Howard, we're seeing more and more states legalizing marijuana, and looks like Illinois, our neighbors to the south, might be on the verge of doing that. Is that something that people could point to on their behalf in a case like this?
Well, so that raises a really interesting question. I've been treating this idea of a compelling interest as kind of a black box and waving it. But it's a real serious question. What does a state government have to show to demonstrate a compelling interest in doing something? In the case of something like drugs, however, generally speaking, there's a long-standing principle that individual states have the freedom to choose for themselves their priorities. So, for example, Michigan has legalized marijuana. Illinois is considering legalizing marijuana. There are a number of other states that have done so. But rather than being an argument that says, therefore, other states' interest is lessened, this becomes an argument about federalism, that states are laboratories of democracy and each state gets to decide for itself how it wants to deal with law enforcement issues. So while I understand the argument, and it's certainly kind of tempting in a way, within our constitutional tradition, the precedents hold that Wisconsin is free to determine for itself what is or is not a compelling interest. And again, given the political makeup of our current Supreme Court, I strongly suspect they will side with law enforcement.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sid is with us in Madison. Sid, hi.
Hey, so I would just say that, you know, a religion has to have more merit than just a few people saying we're a religion now so we can do whatever we want. So, like, you know, even you could even argue that persecution is a merit of a religion becoming official. I mean, it's certainly the story of the Jews, Christianity in Roman times. I mean, there's a thing about persecution that almost grants legitimacy to a religion.
Sid, thanks for the call. So that's getting into that argument, Howard, that you said courts generally don't want to get into deciding what does and doesn't constitute a religion in the face of the law.
Well, that's right. I mean, Sid raises an obviously important point, and one that outside of courts, sort of in ordinary conversation, you know, feels like common sense. You can tell the difference between a 3,000 or a 2,000-year-old religious tradition and something somebody invented last week to get a tax exemption. And so you might think that judges and courts and prosecutors would feel perfectly free to say, well, this one's a religion and that one's not. The reason that gets so complicated is it's not just about what does or doesn't count as a religion, but also what does or does not a religion require. So, for example, someone claims my version of Protestant Christianity requires that I not drive cars on Sundays. There's good reason not to want government officials to say, no, that's not how Christianity ought to be understood, right? There's really, really good, deeply rooted reason central to the First Amendment that we don't want government officials deciding what religious orthodoxy requires. And so to avoid anything tending in that direction, courts have had a tendency to lean over backwards to avoid even addressing the question of whether something is or is not a legitimate religion, and focusing instead on the question of what's the strength of the state's interest.
Thanks for that call, Sid. We'll go now to Gary in South Milwaukee. Gary, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to say about this, Gary?
Well, I mean, I understand religious freedom is one thing. I served the Army and the Army Reserve for 9 years of my life and was the, you know, constitutionally the rights of Americans. But my question is, does that then allow ancient Aztecs to start making sacrifices of people on an altar to an Aztec god that's been dead for thousands of years?
Gary, thanks for the call. In just our last minute, Howard, that compelling interest you're talking about, you know, could run anywhere from an extreme case like human sacrifice to, yeah, our religion doesn't allow us to sign particular kinds of government forms. There's kind of a sliding scale in compelling interest.
That's exactly right. Some cases are easy. Human sacrifice, my religion doesn't allow me to pay taxes, my religion allows me to engage in child abuse. You know, these are easy cases, and courts have no trouble dismissing those claims. Smoking marijuana is somewhere in the middle. And I think you phrased it exactly right. There's a kind of a scale, and the question is, where on the scale of a compelling state interest does this particular case fall?
Gary, thanks a lot for that call. And Howard, thanks so much for joining us again today.
Oh, my pleasure.
We've been talking to Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison and affiliate faculty member of the UW Law School. He was with us today to talk about a federal lawsuit from a Rastafarian church in Madison who say their ability to use and distribute marijuana to their members is part of their religious practice and should therefore be constitutionally protected. That church was raided by police earlier this week. Two of its leaders were arrested on multiple charges. Still time for you to let us know what you think about the case, what you think the outcome should be, what do you think about the arguments here. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Technology was supposed to transform learning, but in some cases it can get in the way, especially in large lecture halls where it can be easy to tune out and play a video game, watch a movie, or go onto social media. To prevent that, at least one school in the Big Ten is banning certain websites in their classrooms. But UW-Madison is trying to keep students' attention another way. Shemaine Mills reports.
The days of pen and paper in the classroom aren't over, but now you're more likely to find laptops in a college lecture hall, and not always for taking notes. It's also used for drawing in this UW-Madison anatomy class taught by Professor Julie Stamm.
We're going to do a lot of drawing and labeling. You'll see that there are templates posted. There's a template today. There's templates posted for the upper extremity. There will be the same for the lower extremity.
The class is designed to be interactive so students pay attention and more of the material can sink in. Technology is there to help with learning, not hinder it. But sometimes social media sneaks its way in. It is, after all, a room full of college students, and the fear of missing out, or FOMO, can be strong. Kaylee Nidas, a junior from Kokona, is enrolled in the anatomy class. It's fast-paced, so she doesn't have time to check Facebook or watch movies, but she admits it's tempting.
I think it's hard for a lot of us to, like, disconnect even if it is for just a lecture period.
Because social media is designed to be convenient, Nita says it's available even when you probably shouldn't be looking at it.
A lot of people have computers that you can text on your computer now, too. So in a class that I take notes on my computer, so sometimes it's even hard to not just take a peek at that when you're sitting in class.
And that's what many instructors are up against. Is their PowerPoint or lecture as interesting as, say, the latest episode for Game of Thrones? Purdue University's taking no chances. In large lecture halls on the Indiana campus, entertainment websites like Hulu, Netflix, and Pandora are blocked by the campus Wi-Fi. Purdue's IT director, Mark Sonstein, says students on those sites during class were hogging bandwidth needed for academic purposes.
Yeah, so last year we received concerning complaints and things like that about the capability of Wi-Fi and the lack of availability to connect to it or slowness on the network, especially in our large lecture halls.
Surprisingly, Seinstein says they didn't get any complaints from students that certain websites were being blocked. Over the years, UW-Madison has had requests to do something similar, but hasn't, says Brian Rust, the former spokesman for UW's Department of Information Technology.
To help students, staff, and faculty, we want to provide the best network that we can and not put restrictions on it.
Back in that anatomy class, upbeat music played while students filed in. Most students don't realize they're in a special class designed to keep their attention and battle all those distractions. But Nikita Patel knows one thing. She likes this class better than other big lecture classes she's taken.
In the past, there have been lectures where professors will just read off of slides, and, you know, that's not very engaging, so students might look on their phones or check social media.
But in this class, students are kept busy. Every 20 minutes, the class shifts gears. There's lecturing, then there's drawing. There's also group problem solving. And students sit close to the instructor. No one's allowed to sit far away in the balcony. Teaching assistants roam the aisles, ready to help students with questions. This type of active learning became popular in the 90s. At UW, it's referred to as the REACH program and has dramatically boosted attendance in large classes. But it doesn't eliminate lecturing or magically make difficult entry-level courses popular. However, surveys show student distraction is lower. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, there's been a lot of talk about socialism and democratic socialism in the last year in politics. We'll dig into the different meanings of socialism and how it all fits into American history. Wisconsin Democrats will hold their annual convention this weekend. They'll look back on their statewide election wins and ahead at the big 2020 elections. WPR's own Laurel White will be there, and she'll bring us the big stories on Monday. And we'll get the latest news from around Wisconsin Public Radio on the June edition of Mondays with Mike. And you can call in with your questions and comments, too. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.